Major Williams, rail 3.
And mortars, 3-inch mortars, and the ammunition for them. So virtually the whole of the requirements, the inventory of the battalion, was now being carried by mules. And this was quite a transformation from a regular battalion that had been motorized or virtually motorized on the Western Desert and still had a significant amount of motor transport when it was actually operating or training in India. Well, this training went on during the course of the autumn of 1943 and ultimately culminated in an exercise which took place over a period of about 3 weeks, during which it was estimated we had marched something like 600 or 700 miles, and incidentally marching with packs carrying round about 50 to 60 pounds in weight, plus ammunition and weapons, so that you really have got the idea that the a battalion that was really by this time quite physically very fit indeed. This had happened, or was brought up to strength, by volunteers from other units. When it was decided that we were to become Chindits, we were not volunteering, we were being assigned to be Chindits, but anybody could volunteer not to be one. The whole situation was explained, and anybody who wished to seek other avenues in the service was free to do so, and without any blot on his record. There were others, and there were not many who did that. There were a few who were not with the battalion at the time, who decided that they were not going to rejoin the battalion. Others who were either physically or physiologically unsuited for the kind of campaign that was anticipated, they were also replaced, and the replacements came from other arms of the service. A lot of gunners volunteered to join us, and armoured regimental people. And so we were made up to a very strong battalion of in numbers of around about 800 from the usual 650. And we were then divided into two columns. And I was animal transport officer of one column, and an old friend of mine who had been in the veterinary corps and in point of fact had been commissioned with me at the same time was animal transport officer of the other column. We each had, as I've just said, about 120 mules and horses. This training exercise, known as Scheme Thursday, finished in December, and then we started moving gradually up to the frontier with Burma and continuing our training in that area. It was not realized, I suppose, at that time, certainly not by me, how we were going to, or by what route we were going to go into Burma. All we knew was that we were being trained to operate behind Japanese lines. I think we all believed that we were going to be marching in. Shortly after we arrived in our concentration areas, I was assigned with two others to work out ways and means of carrying animals in aircraft and gliders. There was no sort of previous experience of this in the British Army. I'm not sure that there was anywhere. Certainly, we didn't get any information from anybody. The air arm at that time, assigned to the Chindits, came from the American Army. And very briefly, what actually happened was that Winston Churchill at the Quebec Conference with Roosevelt was talking about the exploits of Brigadier Wingate, as he was then, in Burma with the first expedition. And he felt, Churchill felt, that some penetration of Burma was indicated by a similar sort of force, which Wingate himself had been propositioning for some time. But the great problem with the first expedition was that there had been no evacuation of wounded or sick. The casualties just had to be left behind, and the force itself actually left just over a third of its number behind in Burma. And this was a very demoralizing feature, as you can imagine. So when this was discussed between Roosevelt and Churchill, the chief of the American Air Force at that time was a man called Arnold, and he proposed to make available a formation, a mixed formation of aircraft that was to be known as the Number One Air Commando, providing gliders, freight carriers that we know as Dakotas in this country, light bombers, fighters, light planes to evacuate casualties, and, surprise, the first operational helicopters of the war. So this formation was gathered very rapidly together and brought out to India, and it's the training that I undertook with two other officers was with the air commander to work out ways and means of transporting mules in aircraft. And the solution in the end was found by lashing bamboo poles into stalls and driving or wedging three mules abreast in the Dakota, and then two more in tandem behind one. So we've got five mules in the aircraft, leaving space by the door for personnel and all the saddlery and all the rest of it. So that was accomplished by about that training and decision taking was accomplished by, I suppose, the middle of February, and it was that time that we then realized that we were going to be airborne, or particularly my brigade was going to be airborne into Burma. And our training then continued along those lines, looking at gliders, being carried in gliders. Gliders were snatched from the ground by aircraft. It was all very exciting to us. And then we actually flew in. Brigade flew in on March the 5th, 6th. The first echelons of the brigade, some of them Kings, the King's Regiment, some South Staffords, were taken in by glider. Some of these gliders, the gliders were taken in or were towed by Dakotas two at a time through the Chin Hills, and we're talking now about mountains really, not hills. The height, I suppose, would be something like 8,000 or 9,000 feet, and the ceiling of the aircraft towing gliders was less than that, so they had to be navigated and at night through and around peaks. It's a very hazardous business altogether, and there were a few gliders were lost on the way over. Some tow lines parted, and gliders landed among Japanese in more than one instance. But the majority of gliders arrived at the dropping zone, and which had been pre-selected. Turned out that it was surrounded by very tall teak trees, and some gliders came in a bit too low and hit the tops of these trees, and there were a lot of casualties resulting from that. But still, the majority of the force were landed, and a message was sent back, and they that the landing had been successfully achieved without opposition, and they were busy clearing an area that was big enough to enable Dakotas to land. And that happened the second night, and I went in. We carried all our mules in by Dakota. Although there were instances, although we didn't do it, there were one or two instances of mules being carried in gliders, but it was not an entirely satisfactory method, and all ours went in by Dakota. We lost two mules only that were shot because they had freed themselves from their stalls in the aircraft and were careering about, so they had to be, they were shot on in the air. Those were the only casualties we had among the animals.
How did you feel as you went in?
Amazingly ordinary, I think. I mean, by this time, it's an extraordinary situation, I suppose, now looking back. We had total confidence in both Wingate and particularly with Calvert, who was our brigadier, that it seemed to be an entirely natural thing to do, to fly in 200 miles behind Japanese lines and drop down and occupy that part of Burma behind them. It wasn't courage or anything like that. It just didn't seem to me to be particularly hazardous.
Had you met Wingate before you went in?
Yes, I had, very briefly. I'd heard him. He'd addressed one or two conferences following exercises, conferences of officers, and I'd listened to him in company with many others. But I only met him personally on one occasion, and that was when the early days of our training. We didn't even know he was around, but out of the we were having stables at that time. Stables, incidentally, is a term used for that period of animal training when they're being groomed and gradually made a fuss of, cleaned and so on. It happens every day. Mules, no less than horses. Anyway, what actually happened was this. Out of the clearing in the jungle, because we're in the middle, central provinces, we're in the jungle there, and out of the trees emerged this strange-looking sight of Wingate, who was wearing his Wellington helmet, and emerged from the trees and came straight over to the mule lions and stood behind one of the mules, was being groomed by a man called Fisher, who tragically is dead now, but Fisher came from Birmingham and had quite an earthy turn of phrase, and he told who he didn't know who this guy was at all to begin with, because he's not wearing any badges of rank, and he told him using a four-letter word to go off, and otherwise his mule would be lashing out at him. I realized who he was and sort of went straight up to him, and Wingate himself was tickled by this little incident, which doesn't seem terribly funny now, but you can imagine that here was the great man, a major general by this time, being told to get off by a rather tough Brummagem mule leader who didn't know who he was. I spoke with him for only a few minutes. He asked me the usual questions, had I had any experience before and all the rest of it. But in that very short period of time, the sheer leadership genius of this man sort of came flashing through. You realized that you were actually in star quality company. And I'm sure that lots of my comrades experienced the same thing.
Can you be more specific when you say he was star quality?
Well, it's very difficult to describe the character of somebody who has this quality. But I'm sure you have met people who are not necessarily imposing in stature, but their personality seems to exude from them, even though they may not be saying very much. I once experienced this talking to Mountbatten some years after the war. You realize that it was not so much the reputation of the man, but here was somebody who had got a particular leadership touch. I think Montgomery probably had it.
Did Wingate make you frightened of him?
No. I suppose his reputation led one to feel a little in awe of the personality of the man. What he was proposing to do at that time, this was before we knew we were going to be airborne, what he was proposing to do was to take what was virtually a whole division of troops, march them into Burma behind the Japanese lines, and play merry hell with them.
Why did he look so strange?
Well, he had a sort of... it was strange to see somebody dressed in the way in which he was. He had this, what it was called in the army, a Wellington helmet. Looks rather like a policeman's helmet.
Was it a Wolsey helmet?
Wolsey helmet, yes. Yes, Wolsey helmet, not Wellington helmet, sorry. Wolsey helmet. He was rather, I've heard this said about him, he was rather like Peter the Hermit, who managed to persuade a lot of reluctant crusaders to go crusading.
In the Middle Ages,
yeah.
Now, to go back to the narrative, you had described the losses on landing, if you can pick it up from there, and can you say more specifically where it was that you landed?
This was in what became known as Broadway. The landing area became known as Broadway. And when my battalion had all landed, mostly safely, we had very few casualties. We then set off to the railway line, which runs north-south between Mandalay and Michinar in the north. And the purpose behind this was to put a block on that railway and deny the use of it to the Japanese for provisions. There was, incidentally, a road running alongside it as well. To get to this railway, we had to cross a range of hills. We marched something like 40 days, and having in mind that we were quite used to marching, and I tell you that it took us 4 days to those 40 miles, I think you appreciate the nature of the terrain we're going over. It was very hilly, sometimes quite precipitous slopes, mules falling down, loads coming off. Anyway, we arrived at a little village ultimately called Henu, H-E-N-U, which was the station of, there's a railway station there, of a larger village called Morlu, M-A-W-L-U. And it was there that Brigadier Calvert, reconnoitering ahead, had decided to place this block, which became ultimately known as White City, on the railway. It was on... were seven little hillocks that overlooked the railway, and that is where we, the Staffords, two columns of the South Stafford's, the Lancashire Fusiliers were the garrison initially of this block, and we found as when dawn broke, as they say, we were actually overlooked from what became known as Bear Hill, a Japanese position. God knows how they had decided to establish one there, but it may have been put there to protect the railway line. I don't know, but certainly not against us, because they didn't know we were going to be there. And so almost immediately, literally from the first day, we were under pretty heavy fire from this, what became known as Bear Hill, and a charge was led by Calvert of South Stafford's, principally, in which I was involved, to take this hill. And it was during that operation that we gained our VC, a chap called Cairns, George Cairns, who was a great friend of mine. He was the mortar officer, mortar platoon officer, but he joined in the attack that was launched up this hill, and a Japanese officer had hacked off his arm. But despite that, he still managed to kill his assailant and was urging his men forward when he literally died. But his example was tremendous at that time. And much later, in fact, he was the last awarded VC of the war. The citation, which went out with Wingate and was initially lost because Wingate, as you probably know, was killed when he was flying out of Burma some weeks later. And when, in fact, George VI knew of this, this was after the war, he caused inquiries to be made, and the citation was, or a copy of it was, recovered, and George Cairns was posthumously awarded the VC.
Can you tell me what your own memories of that charge are?
Rather confused. All I can remember is sort of going dashing across some open ground and climbing a low hill and just shooting at everything that I could see.
What with?
I had, at that time, a Remington. Most officers carried Remington rifles. This is a very lightweight American rifle firing small caliber ammunition, so you could carry quite a lot of ammunition. Certainly more convenient than a rifle. I had a pistol as well.
Did you have a bayonet attached?
No, I didn't have a bayonet, no.
Did the men have bayonets?
Yes, they did. Yes. Well, the men had fixed their bayonets, and it was really almost a traditional charge up the hill.
By how many?
I suppose there'd be about 50 or 60 Staffords in that charge, maybe a few more.
Did you see the Japanese yourself?
Oh yes.
Close up?
Yes. Well, close enough to, you know, I'm afraid that I killed one or two. I mean, they were as close as you and I are to it. It was real hand-to-hand stuff, isn't it?
A few feet.
Mm-hmm.
How did they resist? To the last man?
Yes, they did. They were, so far as we know, all the Japanese on that hill were killed. Japanese are an extraordinarily resilient soldier. Most armies have this sort of instruction ultimately to fight to the last man in the last round, but it's very rarely carried out. But the Japanese do. in all the operations, and we caused a tremendous number of Japanese casualties. We only took about half a dozen prisoners.
Did the Japanese appear to you as personalities when in this hand-to-hand fighting?
No.
Or just as objects?
Just as objects. I mean, the characteristics sometimes of another ethnic group is that they all look very much the same. I mean, all Chinese look rather like the same, don't they, than Japanese. In fact, a lot of Asian groupings have a very similar... We have very dissimilar appearances in the Western world, don't we? English people don't. You can't say he is an Englishman because he looks like, but you can tell a Chinaman, you can tell a Hindu, or you can tell a Japanese, and they tend to look very much the same, and particularly if they are accoutred or uniformed the same. The only Japanese that I had very close contact with, other than that which I've described, was a few weeks later, maybe a fortnight or so later, when I was out on a reconnaissance patrol from the block, and I came across a group of Japanese, about four or five of them, and we alerted them as we came through the undergrowth, and they were diving for their weapons, and we shot them. And one who was, I suppose he was dying, I don't know, but he was certainly very seriously wounded. He was an officer, and I took his sword, which I have upstairs, and I went through his papers, his pocketbook and so on, to try and establish what unit he came from and so on. And I took away everything on his person that I could find. He was dead before I left him, but he seemed to be alive and at the time that I was searching him.
With the charge up Bear Hill, were the Japanese in trenches?
Yes, some of them were. There was a bunker position there. This action is very graphically described by Michael Calvert, Brigadier Calvert, who has written quite a lot about the campaign, but it's graphically described by him, in which he says that he had with him not only South Staffers, incidentally, there were some 3rd, 6th Gurkhas there as well. And he called upon the Staffords to leave their positions and charge up this hill, and exhorted them to show everybody, the Gurkhas included, how the thing should be done. And it was at that point that a lot of people left their positions, and I think on reflection it was unwise to have done so, because if we had not been successful in this,